Good day, and welcome to episode 8 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. This week we're joined by a panel of Guelph politicians and community leaders addressing the broad question, budgeting in the pandemic, austerity or investment? And trust me, the chat is not as dry as that title sounds. It was stimulated by a council meeting in July of 2020, where it became clear that there was a schism on council where the mayor and some councillors felt that in this challenging time, we should have a 0% tax increase, while others claim that continued investment in projects that create jobs, are economic drivers, and that meet our well-being needs are essential now. On July 6th, we are joined by Councillor Leanne Caron, Chief Librarian Steve Kraft, Doug Manette, co-founder of The Bookshelf in downtown Guelph, and a return visit from Julia Grady, the guiding light at the 10 Carden Shared Workspace and a member of the Mayor's Task Force in the Economy during COVID. You'll hear Councillor Phil Ault and myself put in our 2 cents worth as well. Our moderator was Dustin Brown. Take it away, Dustin.
Great. Thank you, James. So today's topic, I think, is going to be a really, really interesting and pressing and timely one. I think it was what I'm hearing is that it was a bit of a surprise on July 27th when the councillors, among some others, went to a workshop on multi-year budgeting and found out that there have been talks occurring somewhere about a 0% budget increase for the 2021 municipal budget. And I hope most of the people saw the coverage in the Guelph Today and even maybe you had a chance to go look at the live stream of that workshop, which is available on the City of Guelph Facebook page. But there were some things that were said about there being no sacred cows in the capital or operating budget, about the potential of some services being privatized or cut significantly in order to avoid what some might consider too hefty a property tax increase for the property tax base. So there's a lot to unpack there. Today we have 4 excellent panelists who have generously given us their time this morning. We have City Councilor Leanne Caron, the Chief Librarian Steve Kraft, Doug Manette, who's a co-founder of The Bookshelf and a downtown advocate, and we're welcoming back Julia Grady from 10C as well. And we'll start with Councilor Caron.
Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity, because there were a few colleagues in the room on July the 27th who hadn't been part of any zero budget discussions. So hearing that coming out of the mayor's chair was a little bit disconcerting, because we're just at the opening phases of the budget stage, and development of the budget is a process that takes quite some time, because public engagement is very much part of the budgeting process. So statements ahead of that engagement, leading staff in a direction that has not been vetted through public needs, public discussion, or through council motion, is not the way that we do budgeting. And in your opening statement, Dustin, you mentioned, you know, sacred cows, and there shouldn't be any sacred cows during a budgeting process. We should be able to talk openly and freely about the community wants and needs, and I hate that expression. I'll talk about that in a bit. But coming up with a number before we've had that discussion is backwards. So my views on the budget and the whole budgeting process and my role as a city councillor actually go back to a key word in James's land acknowledgement, and that is stewardship. Not just stewardship of the land. Our role as a municipal council is stewardship of our community assets, our infrastructure, and our people. Part of the intro that you sent ahead of the discussion, Dustin, was that you wanted us to talk about austerity versus investment. Austerity to me is short-term pain. Investment is long-term gain. And that balance has always been part of the budgeting process. And my experience in life and on council has been that short-term pain and long-term gain are two things that can never be, that when you have to make a budget decision that involves service cuts, there's always a price to pay, whether it's the price on the community and people who live here, but there's always a price to pay later on down the line in increased costs when you need to return that service or that project. So we have put a library is a perfect example. If we had built the library 15 years ago, it would not only be built and operating now, but we would have built it at a fraction, and by a fraction I mean 80% less in terms of land acquisition and capital costs. Putting a library further down the line is just going to increase, and we will all pay that price. So to me, there is no trade-off with short-term pain. The final thing I wanted to say, and I'm probably reaching my 5 minutes, is that during a global pandemic, that's when our community needs our services the most. And the whole wants and needs argument, 80% of what we do, approximately 80% of what we do, are plow the streets, cut the grass, deliver water to your home. All of those things are regulated. We can't cut those services. So the services that we're going to cut are the things that impact people's quality of life. Programs, transit routes, things that we're not federally or provincially mandated to deliver. And those are the exact services that our community depends on during a global pandemic. So cutting those services is not an option for me. I know Steve's going to talk about the library, so I'll hand it back over to you, and we'll talk a little bit more about other topics. But my approach to budget is that we are in this for the long term, and service cuts that impact our community are not an option for me.
I just thank you for inviting me to break bread with you on a Thursday morning. And I echo everything that Councillor Caron said. What I wanted to do was sort of mention that the importance of libraries in the community. And what she said was quite poignant, because I mean, like, we value, quite often people don't think about the library. It's like sort of a silent partner in the community, and yet it's one of the strongest anchors in the community. I mean, when you go to a new city, there's always a library there. There's always a large library in the downtown center of the city somewhere, and it's highly used. I mean, and I think the pandemic has emphasized this, especially the value of libraries. I mean, one thing that we heard while we were closed was, "Why can't I get into the library?" It's an essential, non-essential service, if you know what I mean. And if we're talking about, you know, restoring the economy in any sort of way, I can talk about a 0% increase as well. But I mean, but really, what it does is the library contributes to the health of a community, okay? And especially the mental health of a community. If you want the community or a city to recover from something, from an emergency situation like the pandemic, I mean, you really need a mentally healthy community. There was nothing much to do in some cases, I mean, while we were closed, and yet people wanted, you know, information. They wanted to educate themselves. They were getting ready for spring. They were wanting to do some gardening. They wanted to raise chickens. They wanted to do a multitude of things, and they needed access to that information, and it just wasn't here until we could sort of, you know, reach stage two, where we approached, or where we instituted curbside pickup. And I have to say, just the way that people came back to the library indicates how necessary or how successful, how important an anchor it is in the community. And I will brag about myself one more time, or the library, I should say, actually. When we actually opened to in-person service on Tuesday of this week, it's traditionally one of our busiest day of the year. And in fact, that was true. I mean, people came back in droves to the library, and they came back in a civilized, safe manner. They were all spaced distantly, but I couldn't believe the lineups that were here inside the library. Everyone 6 feet apart, But still, I mean, so it indicates how necessary the library is to the community. Now, the risk involved, I think, in going to a 0% budget is, I mean, like, what does 0% actually mean? Does that include the cost of living or not? Okay, because if we actually have to, if we come to city council with the same amount of dollars, same ask that we had last year, that is actually a cut to our budget. Okay, so we have to think about that as well. But if this, the risk in failing or not moving the library forward or Baker District forward, I think is a real risk because as Councillor Caron said, there are some around the horseshoe there that I'm afraid would like to start cutting. They take the library for granted, as I said. They see it as sort of an invisible partner in the community. It's always there, it'll be fine. But we should have built this 25 years ago when it would have been cheaper. But if we wait another 10 or 15 years, those developmental partners that we have, you know, that have come with us may not be there. It just gets more expensive all the time. And we will not, and there's a risk in not building a library that is the correct size for a growing city. Guelph is a growing city. We are a large urban city. We need a large urban public library. I mean, I think that's what people tend to forget. I mean, we're not just, you know, an agricultural small town anymore. We're a large urban city and we need to behave like it. Now, I think I'm getting away from my elevator speech here, so I'll turn it over to the next person, okay? I mean, I could talk about this for years, but I was going to say, one thing I wanted to draw your attention to was a lovely article in the Globe and Mail from July 28th. It was written by Kerry Gold. It was special to the Globe and Mail as a response to an op-ed about the publishing industry and how libraries are destroying the publishing industry, but it did talk about how libraries are safe shelters and economic drivers in communities. So look for that on July 28th, if you like. So.
Yeah, I have to just touch on one of your last points there, which is that Guelph isn't just a little agricultural town anymore. I moved here in 2016, and it's never been a little agricultural town to me. It's always been a city. So that's the perspective that new people are having when they're moving in here. I think that's important to consider to corroborate your points. So I'm seeing a theme between Leanne and Steve, which is that community wants versus needs. You know, it's maybe a false framing. It's maybe, you know, they're the essential and unessential services, as Steve said. And I think we're going to get deeper and deeper into that through the questions of this discussion. But for now, I want to pass it to Julia Grady. And Julia, maybe you can tell us what's going on in your head and in people's heads at 10C.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dustin and James and everyone. I cannot believe that we're actually having this discussion. It's making me feel very old. So I moved here in 1996, and I think 5 years prior, we started talking about a library. And it's beyond me that we haven't actually implemented. In a weird way, it's kind of good that we have kind of waited so long, because we have like a perfect opportunity at the Baker Street site to do something that will also like revitalize the core of the city. I think the library is a place for books, but it's more importantly a community hub, a place for people, somewhere that's like open, accessible, inclusive to all of us. And I think I can count on my like hands how many places like that we have. The pandemic, I think, made it very clear that we were all like those of us who had the luxury of homes. That's where we went. And our civic life shrunk dramatically. And I think the library is kind of core to civic life. I think it's core to like revitalization of downtown. And I think that dragging this out this long has really contributed to kind of like decimating some of the commercial downtown. And commercial downtown post-pandemic is going to be a massive challenge. I think we relied a bit on all of the residential development and the restaurants and services that would kind of revitalize, but we also then didn't create place for people. So we have a splash pad out in front of City Hall that is kind of a semi-open place for people, but I think by kind of like saying out loud that the library may not happen. We've also said that we're deprioritizing citizens in Guelph. And as elected officials, I think Leanne and James and Phil and the rest of council has really the responsibility to build forward. Government needs to see things that citizens can't see and can't possibly figure out in the moment. And I think we absolutely have to decide how to build a library. In 2008, this seems like a long flashback to me, but at the beginning of the other recession, we had Larry Beasley came to town and we walked through the Baker Street District with him. And we, you know, Larry Beasley, Vancouver, all of the kind of urbanism there. And one of the questions we asked, which was, what would you do differently in that? And he had said he would design space in for the people. And I think Guelph, if we miss the library, we're going to be waiting for another decade, and a full generation of citizens have been waiting for like a revitalized library. I think it's amazing that Steve and team have like kept our existing library active, but of course we need to proceed with the library that we had planned, and definitely I would be on the side of not cutting it. When in a weird way, 10C, which is a community hub, we have about 30,000 people through here in a year doing all kinds of connected cool things, started because Guelph needed civic space. And I think the bookshelf is a civic space as well. And a lot of we're not municipally funded to be that. And a lot of entities in Guelph kind of pick up the slack. And we're also seeing on the civic, on the social side, that there's a lot of other of work that needs to be done in terms of like equity and inclusion and caring for all. So I'm going to end with caring for all, and the library brings us that.
Yeah, I think maybe as somebody who came here to be a student first and then is navigating other spheres of life afterwards, I really notice the lack of civil space when the campus is closed in particular. There aren't a lot of places to go to meet people, to plan community activities, to host political organizations and things like that. So it's, yeah, it would be great to see something like a big new library with a lot of community spaces so that people could, you know, meet in rooms and get things done and just socialize as well. Now I want to, let's go to Doug Manette. You can let us know what's going on for the bookshelf and some other aspects of downtown as well.
Okay, thanks very much. Good to see everybody today. My family's connection with Guelph started in 1885 when my grandmother was born here. And my mother was born in Guelph in 1916. And I was born in the US. I didn't move to Guelph till 1971. I never thought I'd live in a small city like Guelph. And at the time it was very small. I'd like to talk a little bit, my perspective is a little bit different than just talking about the library itself, but it's actually talking about what has always been obvious to me, because the bookshelf was founded in 1973, just prior to the opening of Stone Road Mall, and which resulted in an almost dead downtown. So for me, it's always been looking at what are the pieces of public investment and private investment that can invigorate the entire area. And because really, I think what everybody on this call and what people want to see in their city, they want to see a healthy downtown. They want to see shops. They want to be able to walk by shops. They want to be able to see salons and restaurants and retail stores. Because a library by itself, for instance, whenever I've thought about the Baker District development, yes, the library is a great thing. I visited the library in Halifax. I've talked to Steve about this. It's a great example of what you can do with a new modern type of library. But to me, the most exciting things about the Baker District was the multiple facets that were going to go with it. And in the original conception that a lot of us participated in, it would have involved Conestoga College, aspects of the University of Guelph, the YMCA, all of these things together with the library. So in other words, it was creating a new vigorous center to the city. And by the way, what kind of vigor? This is daytime vigor. This is people who are there all day long. Because one of the issues for somewhere like downtown Guelph is the bars and students in the bars, that works fine. But having daytime vigor is a very important and special thing. So there were things where we made mistakes. We did not buy the post office, which we could have got for less than $1 million. We did not build a parking garage standalone by itself on Baker, thank God, because that would have just it would have been connected with nothing. It would have just been a parking garage. And the power of the Baker development as it's currently constituted with residential, the library, and with potential for parks and rec type activities and educational type activities. It, because of how long this road has taken to travel, we've often missed opportunities that were available at the time. I think Councillor Caron will recall back in the day, presentations by Ian Panabaker, and we trotted out, I think, almost 10 people saying that this Baker District proposal would be great. At the time, we weren't quite ready to go, but I think the fact that we are ready to go now is important. And I'll just make one other comment about this. Yes, council has to be behind this, but also staff have to be behind it. And sometimes I think on this particular project, that because the library is technically not part of city staff, I wonder sometimes where the champion is inside city staff to help drive the bus. And so it often leaves it to people like DGBA and the library to try and push this stuff along. So I would say it's really important. And I'll close because I think with about a bunker mentality, which we have to avoid, the idea of pulling in our horns and pulling back our but making our budget all about can we get to a 0% tax rate is just, it's completely cart before the horse thinking. And I'll give you the three big reasons that are in my mind is one, it's not part of the actual budget cycle for this year. So why would you make a decision before you know what you're talking about to decide? Two, and I've talked to Lloyd Longfield about this, yes, we know there's going to be money coming down the pipe for shovel-ready capital projects. We don't know exactly how it's going to work because the province hasn't figured that out with the feds. But again, why would you decide to have a 0% budget and not be able to potentially react? That makes no sense to me. So, and then third of all, like here we are, we're negotiating with the developer. They've got to try and make a buck or they won't do it. And the decision about even moving that forward, to getting the business terms finally done, you know, we're so close. If you were a business person wanting to negotiate with this city and all of a sudden they pulled the plug on you when you're almost near the finish line, what would you think about dealing with this city? You know, you would talk about the Guelph factor, big time. Anyway, I think this is a huge opportunity. And I think we should maximize shovel-ready projects and investments in the city. And one last thing, going back to thinking about my grandmother being born here in 1885, we all know what this city looked like in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, prior to the building of malls. This was a city that people were wowed by what the streets looked like. They were wowed by the original Carnegie Library. And what we should be doing now is thinking about city building, which is also economically what you want to do in times like these. Anyway, I'll leave it there. It makes no sense to be going to a zero-based budget.
Okay, thank you, Doug. Yeah, it's good context, knowing that there's federal and provincial funding in play here that could be, you know, left off the table if projects don't proceed. I'm thinking too of you know, connecting that to services as well. There's the $40 billion that the feds and the province are teaming up with, teaming up together to give to Ontario municipalities for public transit and other projects and services. So I wonder if that has a part to play in all this discussion as well. But that being said, maybe we can answer that in a bit, because I wanted to just ask kind of my first prepared question here. So we have a few questions that we have concocted in advance, and we'll go through some of those, and hopefully towards the end of the meeting, we'll have some time for some live questions from the audience as well. And Hina Mystery is here with me monitoring the chat to let me know if there's anything of particular relevance in the chat that can come up at any given time. So we're going with the flow here. But my first question for everybody is, so we know that it's been said that in order to reach a 0% budget increase for 2021, then no item in the budget is a sacred cow. Privatization and service cuts might need to be part of the equation. And to quote Tony Saxon in the Guelph Today, Tony said that Mayor Guthrie called for a strategy for the 2021 budget that focused solely on health and safety and provincially mandated services, period. So I think, you know, kind of expanding on one of Anne's original points, and Steve elaborated on that a bit, there are definitely different definitions of health and safety. Like what services constitute health and safety, and you know, which ones are required in order to ensure a healthy and safe community. I want to bring the question to everybody. What are some of the services that you think could first find themselves on the chopping block? And you know, kind of a follow up question: what are the motivations for cutting, and what would be the implications, the consequences, the fallout? We have no established order. Maybe let's start with Steve first this time.
The consequences of cutting, huh? Well, I mean, I'll just give you a little bit of background here. I mean, like, obviously we were closed for a few months, so people are probably wondering how much money did we save while we were closed, because our staff were on temporary leave for sure. But to your point about other costs as well, I mean, like in terms of safety, I mean, like we've had to invest a lot of money in our cleaning staff or janitorial staff. We've had to buy a lot of personal protective equipment. So, I mean, you'll see the plastic, the plexiglass, the shields, the cleaning fluid. Oh my God. I mean, you have no idea how hard it is to get hold of that sometimes, things like that. But I mean, if we're going forward with a multi-year budget, I mean, like, I guess my thoughts are that, I mean, like, Tara Baker, the financial officer at the city, I mean, she has done, she's given us good preparation or good education in terms of preparing a multi-year budget. And now to sort of, you know, throw a wrench in it and ask, someone comes, you know, from outside and asks for a 0% increase means that, I mean, as I said, I mean, we will actually, I mean, have to reduce our services if we try to achieve a 0% increase. You know, that potentially means, you know, closing hours on Sunday or closing evening hours, or even like, I mean, even ultimately closing a branch. I mean, like, I know I throw that threat in front of, you know, councillor faces every year, but still it is a real possibility. If you're asking us to reduce our services, that is ultimately what it might mean. And then how do we get those services back as the economy and as the city starts to recover? I mean, like, it's always a challenge. So, I mean, like, we are actually behind the game if we don't make these investments now, okay? I'll shut up. I'll just leave it at that. And then you can please challenge me on that, okay? So.
Okay, let's go. I will say we're allowing crosstalk between panelists. If you want to agree or disagree with each other, then that's absolutely fine. So let's go to Julia next to comment on services and health and safety.
I don't spend a lot of time in the city budget, so I feel kind of like unprepared to talk about it. But if we're going to a city that just provides water, wastewater, roads, like, that's not enough. And we're like, the tax base of Guelph is increasing and we are densifying. So how can we not do big projects that can support more citizens living here? I don't really understand how we can like subtract something kind of as big as the library. And I would go back to like, what are basic safety is, safety is all kinds of things. It's economic opportunity as well. And vital cities provide economic opportunities, especially for an entrepreneurial based city that Guelph is. So I think we need to also be showing like city needs to be showing investment in community so that the community can be investing in community. Eventually we'll have to deal, and now we have to deal with housing and affordability of housing, but we're not going to deal with that by not doing anything. And to me, like a 0% budget for say it was for the next 5 years, says that the city of Guelph is not going to do anything and we're not going to like make any progress, and we'll take a look at that in 5 years. And I think COVID and everything is just really, I'm an internal optimist, but I think we're in the middle of the hardest period of time we've ever looked at. And the years upcoming are going to be harder than the years we're in now. So I think making like forward moving plans is the only thing we can do.
Great, thank you. Doug, any comments?
I have a couple of comments. One of them has to do with service cuts, because I think if you think about it carefully, like service cuts disproportionately affect people who can least afford it. And so that's why when you do the service cut thing, you're actually hurting, you know, because often you'll hear, you know, folks on some people on council saying the zero increase people saying they're trying to help taxpayers. But really, most of the city can afford to pay the small increases that we need every year in order to expand who we are. There's a disproportionate hurt by cutting. So that's my first point. My second point would have to do with, if you don't invest, you don't get additional taxes back. So a number of years ago, Ian Panabaker, when he worked with the city, did a tax density chart for the city. And it was basically a very cool heat map. And what it showed is the disproportionate amount of taxation that came from the downtown area. And what I would, and that was prior to the Tri-Car Towers being built and the Fusion intensification downtown being built. And what will happen with the Baker District is you will have similar spikes in taxation and relative importance of building the tax base for the city. And not doing that investment instead holds back that revenue coming on stream. So I think it would be penny wise to keep from making the investments we should be making now for making a stronger city later. So those are my main points.
Great. Thanks, Doug. I think that's a great point to make, the first, both of them, obviously. But the first one, I was thinking about all my friends who are relying on ODSP or OW, who have really had a hard time with the service cuts that have gone through the pandemic. And obviously, those are for different motivations, but similar effect if there's going to be a bare bones service provision given by the city going forward. It's really become clear to me, at least, that we need those things back in order to have a more equitable city. So let's go. We have a bit of a counselor's corner here. I'm going to ask for a comment from Leanne and then James and Phil as well.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Dustin. When you talk about essential and non-essential services, I mean, the essential services, right, those are the mandated, those are regulated. We must provide them. If we don't provide them, we're in violation of a provincial act. The ones that are considered non-essential are subjective. So, you know, do we have to provide playground equipment in parks? Do we have to provide the Evergreen Center? Do we need to provide programs and children's programs, those kind of things. So those are going to be the things that are on the chopping block, those non-essential items. And I go back to some of my original comments about quality of life. Quality of life is directly linked to mental health. And I think we've seen that in this pandemic, children being at home and families not being able to play in our parks. Those are quality of life issues that are affecting people on a daily basis. And those are the quality of life services that are affecting low-income families and seniors disproportionately. The crazy thing about this discussion is all of those services, all of those non-essential services, are a teeny, teeny, teeny little drop in the bucket of the overall budget. We could cut every program for children and seniors and low income and public services and cut the playgrounds and the parks. We can cut all of that and it won't make a difference in the grand scheme of that 0% budget increase. If we're to achieve a 0% budget increase, we're talking about big cuts. So where are the big cuts? Big cuts are often linked to privatizing services. And that's a path that I don't want to go down because privatization is a conduit to contracting out to for-profit companies. And for-profit companies are offering less than a living wage for their employees. And it takes it out of the public realm. And there's lots of discussion we can have about that. So privatization alone also will not help us reach our 0% increase. The one thing that the one sacred cow that we should talk about if we're going to reach a zero, and I'm not saying we're even going down that path, is development. As you all know here at Breezy Breakfast, because I know it's been on your discussion, development doesn't pay for itself, and we're covering 20% plus of the cost of development in this city. So all of those big development proposals, all those cranes in the sky that we're seeing right now, we're paying for that. So if we want a really big cut to our budget, we need to slow down, pause, or stop development. But that is jobs and economic recovery. We keep talking about, and the Development Association will tell us, well, jobs, 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 jobs. If we stop developing, we're losing jobs. So even that in an economic recovery model towards a 0% tax increase is not going to achieve the objective that some members of council are trying to achieve. So in other words, you cannot cut services without an economic impact. It's backwards thinking.
Thanks, Leanne. That was a lot. Phil and James, any follow-up comments there?
I can jump in there. Thanks, Dustin. And I'm really inspired by what I'm hearing from all our panelists today. I wish that our whole council and our mayor could hear this discussion. The only thing I would add, because a lot of what I believe in has been said already, is if you as participants in this, anyone that's joined us as guests today, anyone that you know, as we spread the word, it seems to be an automatic default during an economic downturn, which you're experiencing, is for some leaders to go towards that austerity budgeting. And to me, austerity is a euphemism for a social divide, for growing the income gap. And as Doug so eloquently said, when you do cuts, when you look for austerity measures, you are benefiting those who need benefiting the least. And when it increases that divide, we have to make it known to our municipal leaders that's not going to work for us. So I urge all of you to communicate with your own counselors about this. Phil, I don't know if it, or Leanne, it makes sense, but I'll be bold enough to say that in that discussion on the 27th of July, it was the mayor, Councillor Gibson, and Councillor O'Rourke who were leading the movement towards looking for a temporary, as Leanne said, short-term gain with zero budgeting. And I think leaders like that need to know that our community, I fully believe, want to contribute with their tax dollars any way that they can towards the overall quality of life of this community.
Thanks, James. I want to reframe this just slightly, because I absolutely agree with what James and Leanne and the panelists have been stating. But there's a few pieces of information that I think are very important for this. First of all, what's extremely important is to appreciate that the city in tax collection at this point has 80% compliance on tax payment. There has been no real crisis in terms of property owners being able to pay taxes. I have asked staff for a full report on where we are on tax collection before we begin the budget. I'm still waiting for the answer on that one. They haven't actually got back to me, but I think it's absolutely imperative before we have any discussion of 0% budget, which I don't even think we should say the words. I think we should consider them to be as profane as other statements. We should be looking at really what is the city starting with? That hasn't been identified once in any conversation. The other thing that's important to remember is that essentially in a time of restraint, the economic argument that more restraint is a good one is actually a terribly bad principle that started 40 years ago, or 50 years ago, actually. This came out of the Chicago School of Economics, and we've been wrestling with this for the last 50 years. It was a truth that up until the 1970s, the disparity between the top and the low end of income earners was significantly lower than it is now. What we have through trickle-down economics is that we have a few people at the top who have tremendous wealth and a number of people at the bottom who do not. And here's the fact of what we're dealing with in the COVID recession. It's not homeowners and middle-class people that are suffering. It is people at the bottom end of the economy who are really, truly in need. People that are working 3 and 4 and 5 jobs, who Steve sees in the library regularly when there is a normal period, who are using the facilities because they have nothing else. They're people that are using buses. And we have created over the last 45 years a significantly false economic paradigm. And there are a number of very simple solutions to this. Leanne identified that suburban lots actually cost more to service. In fact, on a ratio of 1 for a normal inner city lot, to build Clare Maltby will cost us a minimum of 1.5 times per lot what it will cost us to actually provide and service lots within the city. If you want to know what we can do to actually save money, let's go back to some sound principles of street building. Our streets do not need to be wide, winding boulevards. They can be, like in the old parts of town, far more densely populated. We can still deliver single-family dwellings. We can still deliver semi-detached houses. We can still provide enjoyment with parkland. And we don't have to get into this false narrative of the need for a 0% budget. We shouldn't even be saying the words. And I will not support 0% budget. I will support a budget that is sound and sensible for the city of Guelph.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, largely agreeing with everybody here. If things aren't invested in, then all of those costs are going to be passed somewhere. These services exist for a reason. And if somebody's relying on them and then they're taken away, then that's gonna hurt their bottom line. So I'm just thinking about economy of scale and what power brokers can do to make life easier during the recovery for the most marginalized. I think it's very, very important that we continue with investment. We've talked about the library a fair bit already, but I want to go back to it because I'm seeing some parallels between questions that people are asking and the ones that we had thought up. One of those questions is, why not a smaller library? And I know that's a discussion that's been almost beaten like a dead horse at this point across the city, but maybe some of our listeners could benefit from hearing, who's saying maybe a smaller library would fit our needs and why is that I suspect in the minds of the panelists, not the case that we actually do need the library that's been planned for. And I'm going to throw a few other questions in with this as well, just for the sake of time. Let's not just talk about the library, but let's talk about the affordable housing units, quote unquote affordable housing units that were planned as part of the Baker Street District. Other opportunities like storefronts and creating public space, like a public outdoor square. You know, what kind of value would be lost to the community without this development? And then even going beyond that, legally, what would be the implications of backing out with Windmill and you know, some legal and goodwill consequences? So there's a lot there wrapped up all into one. I'm going to go with Julia first, and then we'll go to Doug, Leanne, and Steve.
Great. I think we need to build the library for the next 10 and 20 years. So I would not want a smaller library. I would, if anything, what we have is already probably a bit of compromise from what was envisioned. And kind of if in the downtown, well, Windmill and the Baker Project and the library being the anchor there unlocks all of the development there, which will increase the tax base. And I'm just going to speak about my little project here at 10C. So when the word underperforming assets, if I think we should start talking more about that parking lot, the Baker Street lot, as an underperforming asset, and how do we turn it into a performing asset? And really with 10C, we've already tripled the tax revenue into the city by just developing this little property here. In 2007-08, when the fire happened in the Gummer building, that fire was one of the biggest gifts to downtown. At the time, we didn't know it, but the Skyline revitalized downtown, increased tax base, and all of these things are happening. And I think we need to be in future mode to plan that and somehow find creative solutions for affordability. I've owned a house and another property here for the last, probably since 2000, and all of our assets are increasing, and we don't really have systems that let us contribute that wealth back into community. And really 10C, by being a not-for-profit, was a way to build forward for community uses versus kind of like privatization of all land which is in our sad and tragic colonial nature. I think it's the library and keeping going with some kind of good plan there is what we have to do. Now I'm rambling, and I just want other people with numbers to speak.
Cool. Thank you, Julia, for giving a crack at it.
Just to help people conceptualize, when we bought this crazy little building, the Ackers building, it's 15,000 square feet, 3,000 square foot footprint. Our taxes were, I think, $20,000 at the beginning. They're now like in the 70s. Like, so 70 grand of tax revenue to the city is like putting in two more buildings. And we haven't had to do that. So there has to be like massive densification in the downtown. And I kind of think if money is a problem and you don't have enough of it, you either have to cut everything or you have to think of different ways to earn revenue. And if revenue is increasing tax base with like more residential, but ideally more commercial, then that's what we need to be doing. Mm-hmm.
Good. Thanks, Julia. You snuck some numbers in there.
Here, Julia. Like, it's about investment. You know, you can cut stuff to the bone and you're stuck there forever. In the late 20s, prior to Roosevelt being elected, that's exactly what they were doing. Or you can do investment like 10C did and look what happens for both the building you guys rebuilt and the tax revenues that flow to the city. So I just like to talk about the to me, really amazing evidence that this city is willing to support things collectively. And it's this concept of localism. So when the bookshelf had to close on the 13th of March and went online selling, between then and now, they have over 3,000 customers and tens of thousands of orders that they've been shipping of books and wine, by the way. It's been amazing. And this is all over the city. These aren't just downtown people. This is the city. And I think this notion of localism is very strong in Guelph. And sometimes people think it's only those downtowners, but nah, it's the entire city. So another quick point I'll also make, because you asked about what happens if Windmill walks. Well, basically, Windmill doesn't lose anything. They lose the investment opportunity, but the city is on the hook for all the design, all the everything. Every expense that Windmill has to date will be paid for by the city. I know this because I know the Windmill guys quite well. So basically, it's a lose-lose situation if we don't go forward with the Baker District project.
Okay, thank you, Doug. And next up is Councillor Curran.
Thanks. First of all, Doug, you're selling wine? I've ordered books. I didn't see wine on your website.
We've sold more than 1,000 bottles of wine.
Thank you. So back to the question about seeing the larger picture. For me, vacant storefronts, vacant lots, means vacant streets. And there's a domino effect. There's if you've ever walked in a downtown where every third storefront or there's big vacant lots, it's not a pleasant experience. And it affects everyone around it. Then someone else is closed and someone else closed. And soon you have a ghost town. So we can't get to that critical mass. We cannot allow that critical mass of vacancies to happen. And the pandemic has just heightened all of that we have businesses downtown that are struggling. It's different at the mall. It's different at the power centers because they're all in an enclosed kind of space that doesn't visually impact their neighbor in the way that the downtown does. But if you have empty storefronts downtown and big vacant lots, it affects everyone around them. And that's why we have a downtown business association. Doug and I are both members of the DGBA, is that bringing people to the downtown affects all businesses, and we do need that vitality of everyone. We can't leave businesses behind in this economic recovery, especially in the downtown. And so Baker Street is key to that. The other critical, I don't want to rehash what others have said, but the other critical infrastructure piece that's happening with the Windmill development that cannot lose momentum is the energy system that Windmill is planning on helping us meet our 100% renewable energy goals. And this will be a showcase piece for reaching that energy target. So if we have a major developer willing to invest in our energy goals to make it a 100% RE development, we need to see that in the ground and we need to see it soon because it affects a lot of other energy projects in and around the downtown because it's a model system. We can't afford to lose that because we want the whole city to help us meet those goals. And this is a key project to get that started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much showing the way. Now, Steve, you're last on this question. I suspect you have something to say about the benefits of this library development.
Yeah, I have some random things here to say, a laundry list of items too. But I mean, one thing I discovered in part of my research when I was talking to the Halifax Library, and Doug sort of alluded to this too, is that before the library was built, I mean, the foot traffic on Spring Garden Street was probably about 1 million people or something like that. I'm going to say annually. I'm not too sure of these figures, but I have heard it twice, okay? Nevertheless, after the library was built, foot traffic increased to 7 million people, okay? So look what that would do to, I mean, as Leanne said, to some of those empty storefronts, right? I mean, like, and they built their library, you know, right after or during that 2008 economic crisis. So there are possibilities there. I'm not going to say that that's, you know, exactly what's going to happen here in Guelph. But I mean, they went out to the community, they tried to raise about $5 million for themselves, not part of the city's money, but you know, for themselves. And they actually raised an extra $1 million to that to the tune of $6 million, right? So again, you know, I mean, I'm not saying our communities are the same, but I mean, like, there are possibilities out there. There are people who want to support the library. I mean, if you build this complex Baker Street project downtown, you are adding to the tax base. You are adding more people to downtown. It's that whole Jane Jacobs thing, too. Eyes on the street, right? Where you make a safer community. I mean, there's Phil Ald out there trying to misbehave. And, you know, there's Leanne. You know, she's got her eyes on him and she's calling the police. I'm just, you know, making that up, obviously. But nevertheless, I mean, there is safety in numbers. And some people, I know that sounds counterintuitive, but I think that is actually true. So, Doug's, you know, facility is open from 9 o'clock in the morning until 9 at night. I mean, here he is keeping those streets active. And we are similar. I mean, like, our branches are located around the city. We have people on the street, you know, all over the city because we are open and servicing them. So it is a good, libraries are democratic, they're economic. I'll shut up. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Steve. There's a lot to unpack here, obviously. And I hope that this has been a good discussion thus far.
Justin, could I just add something too?
Yeah.
One of the interesting things, because I've gotten to know the windmill guys pretty well, and some of us have been pushing for the original concept of the Baker District to development, which would have included educational institution and parks and rec capabilities like the Y. The DGBA has never lost hope that that can happen. And interestingly, when you talk to the developer, they haven't lost hope that they can make it happen either. Because if you look at, and I know the city's redoing their Parks and Rec Master Plan, but probably the area that is the least well-served, if you looked at all the facilities across the city, is the downtown. There are a number of private sector and the Y in the South End. You know, everybody's worried about the South End Rec Center, but I'm sorry, the South End is actually very well served in terms of facilities. But if you look, the downtown area is not. And I think that one of the open-ended aspects of the Baker District is there is still a hope that an educational institution like Conestoga ends up downtown, or some recreational facility does as well, which would, you know, make that library even more powerful in the overall effect by having several institutions there.
That's all the time we have for today, folks. Thanks to our guests and all who joined in for what I found to be an inspiring discussion. Special thanks, as always, to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Ault, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gevert, Hina Mistry, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions, or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. Thanks to you for listening.